Have you ever wondered what really happens to the things we throw away and recycle? The answer probably isn't what you think. Annie Leonard has devoted her life to tracking our stuff, from the raw materials to the design, consumption, and ultimate disposal of all the goods we consume every day. Steve Paulson sat down with her and talked about her book, The Story of Stuff.
Let's start at the landfill, because that's where so much of our stuff ends up. You say that your eyes were really opened when you were a college student in New York City and you visited the Fresh Kills landfill on Staten Island. What did you see there?
Oh, I saw the hidden life of all of the stuff that we have in our homes and our workplaces and our every place. I saw the final resting place of our pizza boxes, our shoes, our iPods, our everything you can imagine. It was such a profound experience that I now actually go to a landfill about once a year, and I really recommend it to everyone. I think it should be required before we get our first credit card.
Well, and just to talk about this particular landfill, Fresh Kills, it was huge. I mean, 4.5 square miles of trash?
Is absolutely huge. I stood there as a sophomore in college and looked out, and in every direction, literally as far as I could see, was waste. You know, furniture, appliances, shoes, food, books. It was just absolutely stunning. I was stunned at both the scale of it, and I was also stunned at the hiddenness of it, the secrecy of it. How could I have gone all the way to being a sophomore in college without ever realizing that our society created that much waste?
But you say most of the trash in a landfill is actually paper.
Well, right now about 40% of our trash in the United States is paper, which I think is a stunning statistic because, you know, recycling has been a household word now for decades, and we could cut our garbage production by 40% just by reducing and recycling our paper. So about 40% is paper. There's a huge amount that's organic waste, food waste, yard waste. There's a lot of metals, a lot of things that can be recycled. It's absolutely easy to get rid of about 80% of that stuff. The rest are things like DVD players and iPods and things where the real problem is not about recycling, but the real problem is at the design stage. At the design stage, about 80% of a product's impact is determined. If those companies made them safer, less toxic, more durable, maybe modular so you could take out the broken part and replace it, then they wouldn't end up in the landfill at all.
Is that intentional, do you think, that some of those products are not easily broken down so parts can be replaced?
I believe it's very intentional. It's all part of a strategy that's called planned obsolescence, or in layman's term, designed for the dump. Our products, especially our electronic gizmos these days, they simply don't last. I mean, I don't know about you, but I grew up with one toaster and one kitchen clock and, you know, one couch and one everything, and it lasted our whole lives. But these days, you're lucky to get a year out of these things. The average cell phone life in this country now is about a year, and they're hard to recycle because they have all different kinds of plastics and toxic metals. They're hard to repair. A lot of these electronic gizmos don't even have a screw, so you can't even open them if you want to see what's broken inside. They're not modular, so it's hard to, you know, take out and replace the broken part. They're designed to be not recyclable in the first place. So our demand to those companies are make them safe, make them last.
Well, what you did is you followed quite literally the paper trail of where all this stuff comes from. What did you find?
Well, I followed it all over the world. I've visited hundreds of factories where our stuff is made and dumps where our stuff is dumped. And what I found is that we have, in the United States, succeeded at exporting the bulk of the environmental and health damage of our products, both when they're made and when they're disposed, so that we can have their continued consumption here in the United States. So increasingly, the factories that make our stuff, which produce waste and expose workers to all kinds of environmental health and occupational safety issues, the factories are relocated overseas. They ship the stuff here. We use it literally sometimes just for a few minutes, like a plastic bag or a plastic water bottle, and then we export the waste back overseas. So we've succeeded in externalizing or exporting the dangers of production and disposal, rather than come to terms with the real impact of our consumption habits here in the United States.
What do you mean we export the waste back overseas? You're saying we're actually literally shipping garbage overseas?
Absolutely. We're shipping all kinds of waste overseas. One of the cases that I explored that I thought was really fascinating was what is happening to all of those plastic bottles that people diligently rinse out and put in their blue bins for recycling and feel so good about. And so I decided to track it. There's a database called PIRS that stands for Port Import Export Research Service, and it lists all of the shipments of everything coming into and out of the U.S. So I studied that for a number of months and saw that there were huge amounts, like millions and millions of pounds of plastic waste being exported to Asia, to Indonesia, to Philippines, to China, to India. So I followed it to see what was there. In one instance, I was in southern India, right outside Madras. It's now called Chennai. And I was tracking where all this plastic was going, because the port data said it was going to Chennai. And I asked the rag pickers, the scavengers, the people who are really the bottom of the economic ladder in a lot of these countries who make a living by collecting garbage in the streets. They always know where the imported waste is going, because that is undercutting their ability to sell the locally collected garbage. So they pointed me to a factory, and I will never forget riding a little rickshaw over this hill in southern India and seeing a mound of plastic soda bottles from recycling programs in the United States. I saw the same thing in China, in Indonesia, in the Philippines, all over. Another waste stream that we export that's particularly hazardous right now is our e-waste stream. All of our electronic gadgets are loaded with all kinds of toxic heavy metals, lead, cadmium, mercury, flame retardants, things like this. So much that recycling electronics, you know, broken computers, cell phones, is potentially valuable because there's a little bit of gold and copper and valuable metals in each one of these things, but also very hazardous because of these hazardous components. So if one does want to recycle those things here, which is technically challenging anyway because of bad design decisions, it's very intensive to do so. So a lot of companies are collecting up this e-waste and then shipping them overseas to Africa and to Asia, where people with no environmental health protection at all, no regulations, break these things open and recover the minute amounts of valuable stuff and then just chuck or burn the rest.
Yeah, but getting back to the plastic water bottles, why are those being shipped overseas? Why, I mean, these can be recycled. Why aren't they recycled in this country if we consume them here?
Well, there's a couple issues. One is that they can't actually be recycled. They can be reprocessed, or what some people call downcycled. With true recycling, you want to create a closed loop. So if you made a piece of paper into a piece of paper into a piece of paper, or a glass bottle into a glass bottle into a glass bottle, then you've succeeded at reducing the natural resource input and reducing the waste output. That would be a closed loop successful recycling. With plastic, each time that you heat the plastic, the polymer chains degrade so that you end up with a lower quality plastic. So right now, the technology is not available to make 100% recycled PET bottle out of 100% recycled PET bottle indefinitely. You can't have true recycling. You have downcycling, where the plastic bottles are turned into a secondary item, which is of lower quality.
So to follow up on the other example that you used about electronics, take me through the trail of, let's say, a laptop computer, sort of how it's made, where that material comes from, and then what eventually happens to it.
Well, laptop computers are a particularly interesting example for a couple reasons. One is how incredibly complex the supply chain is. The supply chain refers to all the places that contribute materials or, you know, have handle this computer at some point during its production. Laptop computers can have materials from 1,000 different places, from mines in Africa, from chemical factories in Gujarat or Malaysia. I mean, literally from all over the planet. So you have a very well-traveled set of components by the time you actually buy the laptop. We then use them for a year or two until they break. I mean, my current one is a year old and is already causing me all these problems. So when you want to get rid of it, there are very few options. In many places now, the land disposal of these things is prohibited because of all the toxic chemicals in them. So you send them to a recycler. Unfortunately, the bulk of recyclers that we've found in the United States are exporting these things to developing countries. And there have been some fabulous exposés. One organization that's done a lot of work on this is the Basel Action Network. Their website is ban.org. And you can see some wonderful images. I mean, wonderful, horrifying images of where these things end up. Increasingly, these e-waste that we send for recycling is sent to Africa or to Asia, where literally whole families sit around with a hammer, very medieval-style processing, just smash the stuff open, pull out the little bits of valuable material, and then chuck the rest. One of the practices that's really concerning is the reclamation of the copper wire. Copper has some resale value, so they want to pull out the copper wire. But it's usually coated in PVC coating. And so they need to get that PVC coating off to access the copper. So one common practice is to just put all these PVC coated copper wires in a pile, light it on fire, and burn the PVC, which is an enormous source of dioxin. So this is an really serious environmental health threat for these e-waste recyclers. There is a way to avoid this, which is to take your used laptop. First of all, use it as long as possible and resist all those incessant Mac ads telling you to upgrade. But when it finally is at the end of its life cycle, take it to an e-waste recycler that is certified as an e-steward recycler. This is a neutral third-party certification system where they guarantee that the e-waste will not be exported to third-world countries.
Well, it's interesting to hear that example because one way to interpret what you're saying is, well, the problem is capitalism. I mean, it's just, you know, lots of companies, big companies, make lots of stuff. That's how they make their profits. They don't really care that much about what happens to it. I mean, obviously, that's not the case across the board. There are some environmentally conscious CEOs out there. How much is capitalism the problem?
That's funny. You've mentioned the C word that we're prohibited from discussing in this country. I find it so interesting how the story of Stuff was attacked so much for being anti-capitalist. Glenn Beck talked about it every day for a week. And when I made the story of Stuff, I wasn't setting out to critique capitalism. I was setting out to describe what I had seen in 20 years of looking at factories and dumps. And when I started getting attacked as anti-capitalist, it made me think a little deeper and go dust off my old economic textbooks. And it turns out that those critics are right, that there are some really core aspects of capitalism that are leading to environmental destruction. One of those core aspects is an absolute fixation on never-ending growth. If our business sector's goal is just growing, 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 it's going to have to come at the expense of something, which is too often the planet. We could have a different kind of economic dominant paradigm where we said that we want a thriving, healthy economy, but not at the expense of the biological systems on which life depends. It's absolutely possible, but under our current dominant economic system, which is capitalism, I don't see how we're going to be able to bring about the level of change we needed to be able to reach ecological and social well-being.
So who would you say is ultimately responsible for trashing the planet? Is it corporations without a conscience, governments that don't do anything to try to regulate what's going on, or is it us who really don't think that much about what we buy and what we throw out?
I think we all have a part in the problem and we all have a part in the solution, but our parts are not equal. I'm critical of these focuses on individual lifestyle changes and, you know, it's our fault that there's global warming because we didn't ride our bike or we didn't recycle or we didn't carry our own bag to the store. Of course, I think we should do all those things and we should definitely strive to live as low impact as possible, but we're operating within a system where the current is moving us towards greater ecological devastation. So these individual actions that we can do, it's kind of like getting better and better at swimming upstream when the current is still going towards environmental destruction. We need to really focus our attention on changing the direction of the current. Rather than nagging our friends to take public transportation, even if it takes four times as long and costs, you know, five times as much money, let's work together to get better public transportation so that the ecologically preferable option is the new default. We need to make doing the right thing as easy as falling off a log. And right now it's not. So you can't really blame individuals when often the best choice is just simply not available.
Annie Leonard is the author of The Story of Stuff. She spoke with Steve Paulson. To hear an extended interview with Leonard or watch her 2007 video that sparked an internet sensation, visit our website, ttbook.org.